Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome back to the Prep to Pro NBA Draft Podcast. My name is Ben Pfeiffer, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host Max Carlin. Max, how's it going?
I'm getting nervous and excited as free agency approaches. How are you?
The wait is finally over. Football's in full effect. With many teams strutting their stuff, you might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to BetOnline today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
I'm doing okay. As we are going to move into the second part of our 2020 draft recaps, in the first part, we talked about some of our favorite picks in this draft, some of our favorite fits, and started with a few of the ones that we didn't like as much. So we're going to continue with those picks that we aren't as big of fans of and just get into some general takeaways and things to track and trends, and then go to our catching eye as usual as we start to prepare and continue to talk a little bit about 2021. Which is a breath of fresh air by all accounts. So
let's go. Same caveat as in part one. We're recording this on Friday, November 20th at 4 p.m. Eastern, which means that free agency is about 2 hours away. So if any of these teams change dramatically between now and Wednesday when this will be released, we didn't know about it. We'll try to account for that in places where it's relevant, but we don't think it'll be relevant in too many spots. If you listen to part one, we talked about that a little bit with the Knicks and Obi. We're accounting for it as much as we can, but we don't know if something big happened.
All right, so the next pick, or our first pick that we're going to talk about in this one is the 10th overall pick. The first, I think, real big shocker of the night, which was Jalen Smith to the Phoenix Suns. Certainly one that surprised us all. Baffled us all to some extent, and just kind of a confusing value here for a Suns team that's kind of showed to just not really care about consensus, shown that they kind of have a type in recent years, just targeting size and shooting. And that's certainly what they got with Jalen Smith, and a really, really good versatile shooter at 6'10 with some perimeter skill. But just the value in the defense, all of that is really concerning and doesn't really make a lot of sense with their current roster construction, given that he is a five and they have their center of the future in DeAndre Ayton in place.
But that's kind of the problem, is that is he a five? Is he a four? What on earth is Jalen Smith? He is a good help rim protector, but really immobile, cannot cover ground, has these mini tiny strides because he's got these high, narrow, and stiff hips. I guess like his best movement ability is sliding laterally, but like I don't know how relevant that is in anything, because he like can't turn or cover ground. And then he's obviously very weak and will struggle immensely as a primary rim protector trying to contest shots where he has guys getting into his body or where he has, you know, centers posting him up or trying to finish through him. Offensively, the shooting is interesting. Like, he has shot versatility as a guy who's 6'10" or 11. That's interesting, but it's not, I don't think it's worth a top 10 pick, for especially when the positional fit is just so weird. Yeah. This was a stunner. This was a real stunner.
It's just the really confusing thing. It's just the lineups. Like, how does he optimize their best units, both offensively and defensively? Like, I assume you ideally, maybe, like, they'll slide him in. They're going to want to slide him in at the four next to CP3, Devin Booker, Mikal Bridges, and DeAndre Ayton. I mean, does he help you more offensively or defensively than Cam Johnson? Like, maybe as like a weak side rim protector, but even there, he's questionable. You play him with a backup five in some scenarios. How much does he really help you there? It's just really confusing, as he has the skills that they look for, and just the height and the shooting. So certainly, I mean, they can run some really funky lineups with their size and their shooting. I just like I'm waiting to see them run a Booker, Bridges, Cam Johnson, Sticks, and DeAndre Ayton lineup. Just put in all of the height and a lot of the shooting. Not necessarily a good unit, but certainly a fascinating one. But yeah, I mean, just the more concerning thing for me, it's not just the reach for Smith, it's the fit and how he works with the lineup and how he works with his team that is now in definite position to make the playoffs and make some real noise in the West. And could have certainly used someone like, I don't know, like Devin Vassell, who is right on the board and went one spot later. So
although I do think the reach is worth addressing, because Phoenix has now done this 2 years in a row. There's not really a problem with going and getting your guy, so to speak, but there is a problem when it's such a reach that you could have just moved down and still gotten the guy and picked up additional assets. That's really poor asset management. And I just want to be like clear that this is not Cam Johnson, because while Cam Johnson was a bit of a reach, like he was approximately a top 20 prospect, at least for me. I think more or less similar to that for you. Like, we liked Cam Johnson. They should have traded back, I still think. But, you know, that worked out fine because he's on the wing. He's a very seamless fit. Like, that's the thing. You don't have to make any role adjustments to get Cam Johnson to work.
Don't need to make any concessions for him to slide.
Exactly. It's very seamless. He's a valuable commodity. He's huge. He can shoot. Jalen Smith is a worse prospect, a bigger reach. I think they could have traded down to get him. You have to make concessions to get value out of him. I still don't even know if that's possible to do in the NBA. I don't know that there is a role in which you extract that much value from him. It's not the same thing as Cam Johnson. It's the same only in that it was a reach and poor asset management. Even if it works out, it's going to work out in such a specialized way that it's not analogous to Cam Johnson, which was, I think, a much more understandable pick and a reflection of kind of what's valuable in the league.
Yeah, we'll talk about more of the value of shooting, but just these teams and the Suns especially, their size and their shooting, they're willing to ignore all asset management and all consensus to kind of go get their guy, which, again, it's certainly it was a shocking move, and one that's definitely questionable, especially given who was on the board at the time and who went right after him to the Spurs at 11.
Yeah, all right, it's time. Aaron Nesmith, 14 to the Celtics. Do you want me to go through why I don't like it first, or do you want me to make the case for him on the Celtics that has occurred to me that I think is a reasonable case to be made, even though I don't buy it and still don't like it?
Sure, let's make that case. Why not?
Okay, here is the case for Aaron Nesmith on the Celtics. The Celtics do not have an offense that incorporates a heavy amount of off-screen bombing. They also haven't really had the personnel for it. The only guy that they've had in that mold who's really an off-screen bomber is Carson Edwards. But Carson Edwards has the problem of being 5'10" or 11". And therefore, when you see Carson Edwards, I think it's a very reasonable assumption to make, especially in light of the fact that you know that he's a great shooter, that he's just a point guard and you can play him as a point guard. That is not the case. Carson Edwards can't really dribble. He can't do anything inside of the arc. He is an off-screen bomber. He's a shooting specialist. That's not how the Celtics used him, and it's understandable. So could you make the argument that a guy who's 6'6 and an off-screen shooting specialist will be used differently, that the offense will change to incorporate that off-screen shooting? I could see the case being made. I don't really buy it. I don't think that coaches tend to really overhaul their offenses to accommodate 14th picks,
especially when your team is already very good and has an established offense in place.
When you have two elite offensive players already on your team, I don't buy that. I think that, you know, we won't see that. But you can make the argument that it'll happen, and then they can extract more offensive value out of Nesmith. You can make the argument that the hitch in his forward momentum pull-ups is correctable. And if that's the case, he can fit more seamlessly into what Boston currently does. And I think maybe the strongest argument is that you can be higher on Nesmith defensively in Boston than you would be elsewhere, because he is 6'6", strong, with a 6'11 wingspan, and has shown genuine facility protecting the rim as a help defender, that he has had some really good moments there. And that Boston is a spot where they have been very aggressive, getting guys positioned on the helpline, ready to deter shots at the rim from that wing position. So I think you could certainly make the argument that Nesmith is in a really good spot to extract defensive value from him, even though he doesn't have the best awareness, mobility, lateral quickness. And then on the ball, the hope would be that the lateral quickness is less of an issue because he's long and strong, and that he has some recovery tools there. So
yeah,
I think you could make the argument that a little bit of tweaks to the offense, and it's a spot to extract a lot out of him defensively, that it could work. I'm skeptical of these points. I don't know that they're the case. And even if they are the case, I don't know that he returns that top 14 value or is better than the guys that they passed on for him. I also should say that the analogies that some people want to draw to Duncan Robinson are pretty ridiculous. Nesmith is not that level of shooter. He doesn't have that kind of range. He can't shoot off the dribble. He doesn't have Robinson's playmaking ability if he does get run off the line. And then crucially, the Celtics don't have Bam Adebayo. They don't have a guy who can flip screen angles like that, who can handle like that, who can make decisions like that. They, like, maybe Grant Williams is that someday. That seems unlikely. Bam Adebayo is kind of one of one. And neither Bam nor Duncan Robinson is himself without the other. They're, you know, kind of a singular entity. So Nesmith is not Duncan Robinson. That's not replicable. That's not how the Celtics offense functions. So that's the case for Nesmith. Ben, do you want to get into like the broad case against him?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like you kind of mentioned with not returning value, even if all of that does go well, and all of it succeeds, he still is lagging so far behind in the areas of decision making and handling and advantage creation, which even if the Celtics commit to using Nesmith off of motion and never give him perimeter attempts, either there's the situation where they fully commit to him as an off-screen bomber and don't give him any perimeter reps, which is just probably not a great use of the 14th pick in terms an off-screen bomber who's not Duncan Robinson and won't help you at all in any other way offensively. But if they do give him perimeter reps, you know, decide, yeah, we'll tweak
on-ball reps
is what I mean. Yeah. Just, you know, with what the Celtics asked their perimeter guys to do, just have that dribble pass shoot skill set. If there, you know, is that any desire or decision to say, you know, we'll try to play Nesmith on the ball. You know, he was a lottery pick. We think he can do a little bit of this. That's not going to be a good situation for him just because he doesn't have the burst or the advantage creation ability or the decision making or the playmaking or the pull up shot creation or the on ball difficult shot making or the finishing to really be confident and competent on the ball as kind of a self operator. So that, especially as you get deeper into the playoffs, that becomes a struggle. And then defensively, you know, if the lateral quickness isn't good enough, someone who can maybe be targeted by better teams in the playoffs as well. Obviously, it's always harder to target bigger wings, but if you have someone who's really able to carving up his lateral quickness deficiencies, yeah, he's going to lose value in the playoffs, which is really important.
And then just a few more concerning points. It's another wing now in Boston who is low feel, bad defensive communicator, bad decision maker, who has poor awareness off the ball, who loses guys off the ball. And then to address the shooting, he is not a 52.2% shooter. The 115 shot sample from his sophomore year is about 50% smaller than his freshman year sample. His freshman, or I guess the freshman year sample is about 50% larger. Of 175 three-point attempts at 33.7%. So his aggregate across the 2 years is 41% on 290 attempts. I think that's about what his true talent level is.
And that's still not even a third of the way to a real stable sample. Like,
yeah, I think that's about what he was probably as a college shooter. And in the NBA, you're probably looking at a high 30s guy. He's a very good shooter. He is not a 52.2% shooter. He wasn't the best shooter in the draft. I know that people really like citing that number because it looks good. It's such a small number of attempts, and there's just no way that I think you can be intellectually honest and make an argument that that's a more valuable sample than the freshman year, or at the very least than the aggregate sample. And if you're looking then at the aggregate sample, it's worse than Desmond Bane, at the very least. This was rough. This was not good.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't the best pick in the world. Neesmith as a sophomore, just again, like, not even close to the shooter that Desmond Bane is over the stable sample, over 4 years. Neesmith not even that much younger than Desmond Bane. Not that much younger.
But I mean, by all accounts, a great dude and can shoot, and hopefully it works out. I think there's a reason for optimism with the defense in Boston in particular, but we'll see.
Yeah, we will. So next we're going to go on to another Knicks selection. That is Emmanuel Quickley, who, what was he, like 24, 25, I think?
25, I believe. I'll double check.
25. It was,
yes,
one of their traded picks. Just again, a real shocker to see someone like Quickley go high. It makes a lot of sense that the Knicks are prioritizing spacing, since their spacing is one of the worst in the league, and especially next to RJ Barrett and Obi and Mitchell Robinson, their core needs spacing to function. But passing on guys like Desmond Bane and Isaiah Joe, with those guys on the board and taking Emmanuel Quickley is really confusing. Quickley, obviously a very, very good shooter, an elite free throw shooter, an awesome volume and versatile shooter off of movement, a little off of the dribble as well. But just being 6'3" and being a shooting specialist is kind of not enough to be a real NBA player, or at least a really, really valuable one. It's Quickley, just not an advantage creator, not a great playmaker, just too small and not really brilliant enough or strong enough to be an impactful defender. Just, I could see the Knicks trying to, like, play Quickley at, like, point guard at some points and, like, have him try to create, and that's just not going to go well. He also needs to be kind of used as an off-screen bomber. And I'm color me skeptical of the Knicks actually doing that full-time with Quickley. I think in theory he could, like, help open the floor for them, but just the value it is not good here.
Yeah, I just worry so much about what happens when Quickley gets run off the line. I think it's almost guaranteed to be bad from, like, a decision-making standpoint, from a getting to and finishing at the rim standpoint. Like, he's got some touch on his runner, I guess. There's not a lot to like there except for catch shooting. And that's just not a top 25 pick. That's not a first round pick. I think that's something that I've seen people, you know, arguing for Neesmith as well, that if he just hits spot ups, then it's fine. But no, lots of guys can just hit spot ups. You don't spend a lottery pick on that. You don't spend a top 25 pick on that if it's a 6'3" guy who just hits spot ups. Those guys are available, and there are guys who can do far more than that. I think the Knicks signed Miles Powell as an undrafted free agent, either to a two-way or I think to a two-way. I think Miles Powell is probably a better prospect than.
Yeah, like, I agree.
Same tier, of course, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, Powell is just as good, if not better, at the one skill that Quickley is good at, plus, like, some actual playmaking ability.
And just like a much more diverse scorer.
Even if they have similar issues, but, like, still. Like,
yeah, 6'3" catch shooters.
Yeah, it's like shooting is really, really important, but I think there's just a misunderstanding of what else you need. Like, you need more than spot-up shooting to be a valuable fourth or fifth starter. You need ancillary skills. You need plus decision-making or a little bit of handling or some special passing or finishing or cutting or foul drawing or something.
We like Desmond Bane so much as a guy to be picked in the 20s, because he is that elite level shooter, or not NBA elite level shooter, a high level shooter who has all of the ancillary skills you could want. He's got the team defense. He's got very plus playmaking for the role. Like
great decision making. Like
exactly. Like he has all the ancillary skills you want. That's why he's a good bet to be a solid rotation player, or maybe in the right situation, a bad starter. Like that, he has the ancillary skills that you want that bring a guy over the top instead of just being a shooter.
Yeah, and quickly brings you none of that, and just very concerning.
Okay, next we have. That I'm only going to talk about once because it causes me too much pain. The Celtics at 26 selected, like, probably my single least favorite player in the draft, Peyton Pritchard, point guard out of Oregon. Going through this quickly, so I don't have to think about it too much. I don't trust him to create good shots for himself. He's a good shooter and a really talented college shot maker as a small guard, but the diet of shots that he lives on is incredibly difficult and unsustainable. And that's why you saw a variation in his shooting percentages across his years at Oregon. He really just takes tough shots. He is not a good decision maker at all. He's really a score first guard and leaves a lot on the table as a decision maker. And then defensively, I thought he was pretty terrible at Oregon, just like dying on every screen. Really conceding a ton of dribble penetration. Like, he would just halfway through a drive just like totally give up. Maybe that gets better with a more reasonable offensive role. I consider me skeptical for a guy who's also really old. I just don't think he's much of an NBA bet. I think that the absolute upside you're looking at with him is like a third or fourth guard. That's crazy to me to take in the first round.
Is he better than Brad Wanamaker at his peak?
Oh, God, no. No, I think Wanamaker is a pretty good player.
Yeah, I do as well. Is he better than Trey Waters? Almost certainly not.
Oh, right? No chance. No chance. No,
Waters is really talented.
Yeah, so I thought this was really awful. It made even more painful by Malachi Flynn going three picks later, and that's just going to be something that's so painful to track that – with that divisional rival, you're going to have Malachi Flynn, who I believe in so much. And then you've got Pritchard, who I think is not even the best NBA bet. That one was rough. That one, Neesmith, I can make the case for. I can understand the logic with Neesmith. I can see a way to it working out. Pritchard, it's tough. I think what you're shooting for is something that's not that valuable in the first place, and I don't think he's a good bet to be that. This was I think one of the worst picks of the night for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the traits you look for in backup point guards, you want some kind of, if they're a backup point guard who's going to run your bench offense, you want some kind of advantage creation. If not, or even if they are, you want sound decision making, someone who's not going to make a lot of mistakes, and you want defense. So, yeah, Peyton Pritchard gives you none of that, which is a real issue. As he's not better than any of the backup guards the Celtics have had. He doesn't really do any of the things that you want your backup initiators to do. And the value. I think both of us had him like in the 70s or 80s. Like it's just a baffling selection to me, like, especially like given all of the guards, like we talked about the guard depth, and like, you know, some guards are going to get picked higher, some are going to fall, some might go higher than we expect. I don't think we expected Peyton Pritchard to go this high, passing on Nico and Dotson and Terry and Riller and all of these guys, and Trey Jones even, and Malachi Flynn. It's confusing. It's really confusing.
Yeah, not good. All right, next. We've got, well, I guess this next one is kind of a group. It's these traditional bigs who went throughout the first and early second. Specifically, Udoka Azubuike at 20, what did it end up being, 7 to the Jazz? Yeah.
27, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Doak, 27 to the Jazz. Isaiah Stewart, 16 to the Pistons. We can throw Carey at 32 to the Hornets. Oturu at 33. to the Clippers.
Even Nick Richards again.
Nick Richards was the other one I was thinking at 42, also to Charlotte, I believe. We're going to talk about this a bit later, but all of these traditional big men, it seemed like they were, I thought that they were, a lot of them were going to fall, and that didn't end up happening. It happened with the guards, but it didn't really happen with the bigs. To talk specifically about a few of them, I guess, Doak at 27, like, I like Doak. I think he fills a specific role. He can be a lob threat. He can play short minutes. He can bring some rim protection. He's not going to be a mobile option. He's not going to stretch the floor. He's not going to play huge minutes. Like, he fills a very, very specific role. Would have been totally fine in, like, the top half of the second even. But to spend a first-round pick on a guy who's going to play such a narrow role as a center is just weird. It's just it's similar to Pritchard. It's just, what are you hoping for here? You're not drafting Doak because you think that someday he could be a 25-minute-a-game starting center, I don't think. I hope not. You're drafting him to fill a small role, and that's such a weird...
Seems they drafted him as their immediate Tony Bradley replacement with a very confusing use of a 27th overall pick with lots of players of significant need for the Jazz that they could have addressed. I mean, the Jazz, later in the second, they took Sabin Lee, which was an unexpected pick, but filled the need for some half-court
creation. Sabin Lee...
Oh, wait, no, that's the...
That was the Pistons. It was their pick, but it went to the Pistons. They got Elijah Hughes.
That's right. I forgot that. Never mind. But still, you know, like players like Bain and Joe and even like Dotson, there were prospects that fit their needs of shot creation and rim pressure and playmaking on the wing. And backup big, presumably, I didn't think was that big of an issue for the Jazz. So unless they just really liked Udoka, I mean, I am also a fan of Doak. I think he could be a pretty solid rotation player. Again, like on a team with Rudy Gobert, like it the value is less stark than Pritchard. Still a confusing use of assets and a confusing fit nonetheless. It's just a weird one for sure.
And then we've got Oturu at 33, second year in a row that the Clippers have traded up for a big man who's not that good. I think Stewart is probably worse because it was just a much higher pick. But 33 is a very real pick. There were really good prospects on the board, including like Xavier Tillman, who like ate Oturu whole both times that they played this year, and dominated the conference that Oturu played in. Oturu is just—he's just not good. Like, I don't really think that he's much of an NBA prospect. I still don't understand what the appeal is with him. I guess he's a rebounding specialist. I don't think that he's a compelling, like, shooting big man. That's, I guess, what people say. I don't really buy that much. I don't think there's that much reason for that. And he's a terrible, terrible defensive player. He cannot defend a pick and roll to save his life. I don't understand what the appeal with him was at all. I don't get this pick. It's weird.
Taking him like a couple spots ahead of Tillman is just crushing.
Like, yeah, it's just baffling. I mean,
taking like the worst passing pick in the draft 2 years in a row. It's really like they've got a type, especially when I think one of the Clippers' biggest needs is playmaking and like a legit dribble handoff facilitating big, I think would unlock a lot for that offense. And they had the best one in the draft sitting there for them to take. I think Tillman would have been a really, really good fit on the Clippers.
And then they're stored at 16 and, yeah, this one was stunning. I don't really know what they could possibly... to go from taking Killian to taking Stewart at 16 was rough, especially with who was on the board. That there were some real compliments to Killian available. That there was Maxey available. There was Hampton available. That they could have gotten a guard who could bring the rim pressure that you need alongside Killian. And they went for Isaiah Stewart, who... Like we talked about with Killian, you want like ideally a dual threat role pop big man, and Stewart is neither. Like, he can't jump, so he's not a lob threat. And I think that the idea that some people have of him as a shooting big is possible. I think it's more possible than Oturu, but I don't know that there's that much reason to bet on it. He can't move at all. He can't jump. I don't really think that he's an NBA player. This one
is tough. We talked about the Pistons would definitely be good to get a long-term big compliment to Killian. Obviously, you want someone who can pop with him, who's a lob target. I guess maybe they think Stewart is that. I don't think he is. I'd be very shocked if he was that. The idea of getting a big compliment to Killian makes sense. Yeah, just given the value of who else was on the board, how many positions of need that other positions of need they could have filled with just great talent like Maxey, Poku. Yeah, it's a confusing one.
Yeah, I can understand a lot of other picks. This one is tough to swallow. This one I don't understand at all.
The wait is finally over. Football's in full effect. With many teams strutting their stuff, you might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to BetOnline today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Support for the Prep to Pro NBA Draft podcast comes from Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Jingle balls to the walls, fellas. Listen up. Untrimmed pubes are a thing of the past. It's time to gear up and get yourself the gift of shaving this holiday season. I am talking about the Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0. The Lawnmower 3.0 comes inside their brand new Perfect Package 3.0, which makes for the perfect gift this holiday season. It's literally everything you need to keep trimmed, cut free, and smelling nice down there. The Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0 also includes the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. You already put deodorant on your armpits. Why are you not putting it on the smelliest part of your body? And yes, your balls stink. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code ARMCHAIR at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code ARMCHAIR. Clean up your nuts and make Santa proud this year.
Yeah.
All right, that's the last of our least favorite picks. Let's get into some things to track going forward. Something that we talked about a lot throughout the process was high leverage physical developments. If you want to listen to more on that, we have a couple episodes specifically on that. But I'm very curious to track how LaMelo Ball develops physically. You know, how does his core strength come along? How does his balance come along? Does he make strides as a finisher? Is he able to play through contact more? Is he more balanced on his jumper? Killian Hayes, do the athletic improvements continue? Obi Toppin and Jalen Smith, can their hips get better? Is that at all possible? I'm very doubtful of that because, you know, their hips aren't going to get wider. But, like, can Jalen Smith get more flexible in his hips? That seems possible, maybe. I'm kind of skeptical of it, but we'll see. Isaiah Joe, can he get a lot stronger and therefore, you know, improve his jumper accuracy and his ability to fight through screens and maybe get to the rim more? You know, that's a potentially very high leverage improvement area. And there are more of these guys, but just tracking how the physical development works for this class with a lot of guys who stand to gain a ton from developing physically in specific areas, I think it'll be a fascinating thing to keep watch.
Yeah. And then one more thing that we're tracking of is just how these prospects that need specialized contexts and very tailored roles to thrive do. Starting with Okoro, are the Cavs going to commit to maybe using him in off-ball motion, getting him working downhill off of the ball or with an advantage, using his slashing and his burst and his finishing and kind of mitigating his spot-up shooting weakness. Denny, are the Wizards going to not ask him to create, use him in transition, have him as a secondary, you know, cutter, playmaker, and weak side rim protector? Precious, like we talked about last time, are the Heat going to commit to using Precious as a straight five and as a compliment, not as a compliment to Bam on the floor, but as a backup and as another piece?
And like, how close can they get him to being Bam, like, especially yeah, right. on the defensive end, like how much progress can you make with getting him to be less jumpy on offense? Like, how can you turn him into a real switch everything guy? I'm a little skeptical because I think that jumpiness is kind of always going to be there. But if you can get him to be, you know, viable in switch everything, that's a high leverage application of him.
Yeah, and like, is Boston going to commit to applying Aaron Nesmith in a way that's going to have him succeed? There's a lot of these really specialized prospects that need specific roles to succeed and can have a lot of success if they're used in that role. But just to what extent teams are willing, teams understand their player strengths, limitations, and how they're willing to optimize those.
Yeah, I mean, we talk so much about context throughout this entire process because this is such a context-dependent draft. And those questions aren't answered on draft night. For some of these guys, they are answered. For Haliburton, I think they were answered, and they were answered super well. He ends up in a great spot. For Denny, I think they were answered. He also ends up in a spot where they've got two big-time creators. And honestly, we probably should have mentioned him among favorite picks that you know, maybe, I guess, a little bit of a reach, but I think right tier and a really good spot to get a lot out of him. So some of those questions were answered, but certainly not all of them. Neesmith wasn't answered, Precious wasn't answered. A lot of these things are still TBD. It's just something that we're gonna have to track for years to come, because I wouldn't expect that we'll necessarily see, you know, Boston overhaul an offense for Neesmith in year one, but maybe in a very, very limited role in year one, it looks like he does look like more of a special shooter than we thought. And in year two or three or four, they are making adjustments to really get a high volume of Aaron Neesmith movement threes. Maybe he does take well to this defensive scheme, and he is able to impact shots a lot at the rim. It'll just be interesting to see how the context does actually end up influencing the outcomes that we see for these guys.
Yeah. And then there's some general takeaways and trends. The first one that we talked about a little more is the teams are still drafting limited bigs. I think there's kind of an ideology out there that like bigs are like running backs, like they don't matter. I definitely think that's not true. Bigs, while they are certainly more replaceable and more fungible than someone like wings, special bigs with real like specialized skills like Okongwu's coverage versatility or Najee's movement or Tillman's decision making and strength and screening and all that, those high leverage skills are not replaceable and very useful in a playoff setting. But these kind of like more ground bound plotting bigs without perimeter skill or decision making or weak side rim protection, those types are replaceable and are easy to find players who can fill that role if you even want to fill that with. You probably shouldn't be. And like we talked about with Stewart, with Udoka, with Oturu, with Carey, with Richards, these bigs seem to still be valued to a pretty solid extent, which is certainly interesting given the direction the league is going. I mean, maybe with, you know, the league is getting like bigger, like with, you know, bigger initiators and creators, but that's not in like bigger traditional bigs. It's bigger and more skills. That's definitely an interesting trend to track to see if teams maybe, you know, continue to value that in future drafts.
Yeah. If you're not getting a once in history talent like Nikola Jokic, a big is not going to be the center of your offense, and therefore is probably not going to be the ultimate team building piece. However, like the perfect big man is probably like the perfect complementary piece and really a significant ceiling raiser. I mean, you see how much of a ceiling raiser Anthony Davis is by being the team defense and coverage versatile like key that he is, while also getting his offense in ways that are just, you know, cleanup duty and not necessarily something that has to be central to your offense, not something that you have to really build around. It just kind of happens naturally and is very, very additive in an easy way. That sort of guy is super valuable. That's why Onyeka Okongwu is super valuable. That's why someone like Tillman is potentially very valuable, or Killian Tilly. But it's these, you know, a guy who's 6'11", can't move laterally, can't jump, is a post-up college big man who's good at that in college. Like, that's not going to be the center of your offense. What is he going to be in the NBA? I guess Vernon Carey is not the best example, because I do think that he has some like role man ability and maybe some face-off ability and maybe could shoot and is kind of nimble. But what is Isaiah Stewart, who is a post-up big man in college? What is a guy who's 6'8", can't jump, doesn't pass, like can't really handle, as of now can't really shoot? Like, what is this guy in the NBA? He's not a post-up big man. You're not posting up Isaiah Stewart. So is he playing as a role man? What pick and roll coverage is he playing? I don't understand how this guy is supposed to generate value. I'm curious what the Pistons think. I'm curious how they're going to try to use him, but I'm certainly skeptical of the value. And the same thing applies to Oturu and less so Doak. Doak fits a very specific role, and it's just a question of how much value you can get out of him. But I just don't know what you're doing if you're drafting Isaiah Stewart or Daniel Oturu. Like, what is the plan there? And the NBA continues to do it. You have all these guys going in the top 35. It was weird. Definitely weird.
Yeah, and the next trend is, as we talked about a little before, just that, like, we see how much the league values shooting. We know how much the league values shooting. They continue to just push the bounds of how much the league values shooting. The Jalen Smith pick, most emblematic of this as well, valuing shooting, valuing three-point percentage specifically, as you know, they don't value as much a guy like Maxey, who was a bad three-point shooter in college but is an obviously good shooter, value a guy like Sticks and someone like Nesmith who has the 52% three-point, value a guy like Quickley, someone like Pritchard, who are all like accomplished shooters. Like, it's like I think the priority makes sense, like spacing is king in the modern NBA, but there's just a misapplication of it to me at least, and I think the smart teams are taking advantage of that.
Yeah, the seeming reliance on three-point percentage is weird, and we don't have. I mean, I'm not confident necessarily in my ability to project shooting out, but I don't think that going up, especially off of 1 year shooting percentage, is the way to do it. I mean, if you flipped Aaron Nesmith's shooting seasons, it seems highly unlikely that he would go in the lottery. If Cole Anthony shot to his true talent level, I think there's no way he goes at 15, and probably he might go 10 spots higher. Tyrese Maxey, the same thing is true. If he shot at his true talent level, there's no way he falls to the 20s. And then Quickley, you know, again, if you flip his shooting seasons, there's not a chance he goes in the first round. He probably doesn't get drafted if you flip his shooting seasons. So I think that this reliance on three-point percentage that we know is such an unstable metric on that small sample, I think that it's kind of a recipe for disaster that – shooting evaluation, it's a tough thing to do, but I think strides definitely need to be made there, because it's not great if you're drafting Emmanuel Quickley because he is supposedly an elite shooter. If he's not actually a special shooter at 6'3", that's, I mean, even if he is a special shooter at 6'3",
I was gonna say, even if he is, it's not looking great.
Yeah. All right. I think that's probably all we've got on the 2020 NBA draft.
Yeah. That's all. Wow. This plus the other 69 episodes that we've done on it. I mean,
unbelievable.
That's crazy.
All right. Catching Eye.
Yep.
Do you want to go first or should I?
I think you have the big one, so you can go first.
All right. Let's talk some Keon Johnson. I am still working my way through the Keon Johnson film. For people who are just now becoming aware of Keon, because we're at the start of a new draft cycle, Ben. We have talked Keon some on this podcast. We definitely talked about him with Ross Homan, who is the foremost Keon Johnson fan in the world. Keon is a 6'4", 6'5", combo guard who's going to be playing at Tennessee next week.
Next week.
Keon is an unbelievable athlete. A ridiculously absurdly special guard athlete, the most bonkers vertical leaper, like off one, off two, through contact, insane vertical athlete, crazy bursty. There are issues with him from like a feel standpoint, from a handling standpoint. The shot is somewhere between not good and good. I think there's a reason for optimism. I don't really, it's tough to evaluate shooting for young guys. I don't know where Keon's at. That's going to be really important for his projection, but it's not a disaster. But the thing I wanted to talk about right now, because I'm still in progress with the Keon evaluation, is his like spatial awareness is really unique. And I know that this is something that Ross has talked about. I haven't fully read his big Keon piece because I'm waiting until I have my own thoughts. But I know that this is something that he's talked about, that Keon's spatial awareness, just his usage of space is very unique. That his movements and ability to create space and move in space are really unique. That he gathers perfectly and creates contact perfectly to create angles for finishes. That he seems to know just the right amount to use his really good body control to contort out of the way to still get contact and get a foul call, but maintain his balance and have a reasonable chance of finishing. It's like he has this sixth sense for where he exists in space, and it's really incredible to watch. It's hard to explain, but just this feel for getting himself open with little bumps, this feel for off the ball, for freeing himself up with little shoves and little like change, like little feints and change of direction. it's really unique the way that he just operates on a basketball court. It's fascinating. I don't really know how to describe it. I think Ross has some fancy term that he's gotten from biomechanics people. Check out Ross's piece on Keon, of course. But really, really fascinating guy physically. Truly special physically. And I'm especially like I said, with his ability to create space on and off the ball with like subtle nudges and stuff like that. When he is in the Tennessee strength and conditioning program, when those bumps, when those like perfectly timed up gather and dips his shoulder into the guy's chest, when that's post Tennessee strength and conditioning, those guys are going to be thrown 35 feet because Keon's already like pretty strong, but Tennessee strength and conditioning, oh my God. I mean, he's going to be a total monster. I'm excited to see where his handling's at, where the shot's at, where his decision-making's at. Like, I don't like the way he reads the floor at all as a guy with the ball in his hands, but really special physically in a cool and unique way.
Yeah, I think another big reason for positivity with Keon for me, I think I'm more done with Keon than you are at this point, is that I think he really is on a positive development curve. Really did improve kind of noticeably and significantly from his last season of AAU to his senior season of high school, where obviously, yes, the competition level is not great. And obviously you see him dominating physically in a way that he should. He just like lives at the rim, gets all of the easy buckets, which is what you want to see from him. It's nothing that spectacular. But what is really impressive, I think, how about kind of that spatial awareness feel for creating space? I think he's just improving as his court mapping as well. I think the decision-making, he's just like processing the game. Things are moving slower for him. His decision-making is better. He's making more basic reads, still nothing super complex, but he's making more basic reads consistently, not really missing the passes that he used to miss. And again, I think he's getting craftier. The handle's a little better. I think he's better at using deceleration and change of direction in the paint to create space for himself, apart from his incredible physical tools, which he can use whenever he wants. But at the highest level, he's going to need a little more to create space consistently against the best defenders. And then I do think the shot has really progressed as well. Besides just looking nicer, I think he's more confident shooting first most off the dribble, but definitely off of movement. Where I think he flashed a little more than in UIBL, or not UIBL, in Adidas. But yeah, overall, like the development curve plus his, he's pretty young too, right?
I believe he is, yeah.
Yeah, he's young too as well for the class. The incredible physical tools. I mean, that's like a pretty surefire top five prospect next year. I'm not going to have him too like Ross, I think, just because I have role concerns. And a little worry about just the general skill. But the development is great. There's probably not two better landing spots in the country for him than Tennessee, especially playing next to another really, really high-level guard prospect in Jaden Springer. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see Keon end up top three on my board by the end of the year. Like, he is really, really good. Just a one-of-a-kind physical talent with, I think, positive skill improvement and feel improvement in terms of his playmaking and decision making. Yeah, a really, really good prospect. Definitely one of the ones I'm most excited to watch.
Yeah. And whenever this comes out, he'll play soon after. He might play the day after this comes out because college basketball is so soon. That means that if you're listening to this on Wednesday when it comes out, tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern. Two days from when you're listening to this on Wednesday, 11 a.m. Eastern is Auburn Gonzaga, Sharif against Jalen Suggs.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
I'm so excited. It's a huge test early. I'm so excited for Suggs also because we love Suggs.
Excited for Anton Watson.
Yeah,
it'll be fun.
Hopefully Anton Watson was better than he was in the Gonzaga scrimmage because that was ugly, but it was a scrimmage. So, excited. College basketball is here. We're going to be watching Cade. We're going to be watching BJ. We're going to be watching Zaire. Oh my God.
Jalen Johnson on the weird ass Duke roster. I mean,
yeah, Bizarro Duke.
It's going to be an absolute show. Like,
I'm so excited. Yeah. We've already got international games. We've got the Garuba games piling up, the Roko games. Allison, everything. Oh man, it's wonderful.
It's really 2021 draft season. Speaking of Duke, I wanted to talk a little bit about Jamin Brakefield, who is another one of their many weird freshmen who I originally liked quite a bit, but I have moved down on considerably. He is like a 6'7", 6'8" guy with a real dribble pass shoot skill set. Like he has nice shooting touch and nice floater touch. He shows playmaking flashes with both hands, ambidextrous finishing and ball handling. He's just like such a bad and weird decision maker. On offense, he can't create any space for himself on the ball in one-on-one situations. Has really no burst or strength or vertical explosion in tight spaces. He can definitely get up with some room, but in tight spaces where it's more functional, it fails to embarrass him. Just makes weird decisions on offense, like passes that you'd think he'd make that he just doesn't. And then on defense, like, he's just like late on every rotation. Like, he's consistently late on just about everything, like just a half second late helping the helper or getting back in transition. But like, he'll occasionally make a play and he's like pretty capable laterally for a guy his size, but just and he's also really old for his class as well. So I'm just confused at what he's gonna do for Duke. I mean, I think his spacing is gonna definitely help them. He's gonna be able to attack closeouts with his playmaking and the ambidextrous finishing and dribbling. Just more and more skeptical of what his NBA role actually is, as someone who is a bad decision maker that can't create advantages, isn't an overwhelming athlete, is old for the class. Still someone I ranked in my top 60 just because I'm slightly optimistic about the skill set. But yeah, I'm definitely not the Jamin fan I used to be. Quite the contrary. I think he's probably like I don't know, like the sixth best prospect on that team, like seventh. I don't know.
They have a bunch of good prospects, and I don't really think Jamin is among them. Ben, you've seen the light. We're happy to have you. Would you like to do your next one?
Yeah. More fun one. I have Xavier sophomore big Zach Fremantle. Real catching eye roots guy, kind of guy here. I caught him watching UConn Xavier earlier in the year, prepping for more book night. And just finishing up with Najee Marshall stuff. He had one of the best big man defensive games I've seen in a long time. Like, he was spectacular. It was really, really unique. Just his rim protection was unbelievable. In really every way. He had timing blocks and transition where he'd kind of contort his body and place his hand perfectly to get the rim. He'd flip his hips and drop against a quick guard and rise quickly for a block. He'd come from the weak side after he gets beat on a switch, peel down and spike a shot off the backboard on the first pass. It's just kind of ridiculous, his ability to move at 6'9", about probably 230, not a crazy vertical athlete or anything, but his mobility and hip flexibility and drop, even on a couple switches, was totally unreal. Like it was bonkers. Not gonna like put too much stock into that one game. Pretty much does nothing on offense at this point. But that rim protection and that big man defense, despite being limited, you know, size wise and athletically, certainly something to track. Probably, I don't know if he's ever actually an NBA player. Will probably be a really good college player at some point. Maybe when he's a senior, if his offense develops, he can be a fringy guy. But like, the rim protection is so ridiculous. Like, it was unbelievable. And I think there is potentially something real with him to track, as, you know, if he ends up shooting, maybe if he continues to play like this, just a guy who I'm going to keep my eye on for next year. So.
I have no Zach Fremantle takes. I'm curious to pay attention to him.
Yeah, I figured you wouldn't.
All right. Is that it? A bow on 2020?
Wow. Yeah, that is our bow on the 2020 class. It's been
unreal.
It's been quite a 17 months for the cycle. Quite a, what, like 7 or 8 months for this podcast.
Yeah, let's never spend that much time on one draft ever again.
Let's hope we never have to. So thank you all for listening, as always, today and through all of our 2020 content this year. You can follow the pod on Twitter at @prep_2propod. You can follow Max at @MaxAcarlin. Follow me at @Ben_Pfeiffer_. And with that, we'll catch you all next time.